So today's lecture is headache, and as usual when I give a lecture, I tend to take a very outpatient-oriented approach, so we're not talking about doing any subarachnoid hemorrhages here or things like that. We're trying to stick with what 99% of headaches that come to an internist are going to be about, and try to make sure you all know how to handle them well. Okay. So we all get headaches, so why would a patient go to a doctor if we all get headaches? It's basically normal to get a headache because we all get headaches. Anyone in the room never had a headache? We all get headaches. I once had one person raise a hand, so you never know, but I'm very jealous of that person. So why do they go to the doctor?
Because they have associated symptoms, or the frequency is too high.
Okay, a high frequency gets towards my first point, I guess, which would be severity. So either high frequency or just very, very, very bad head. But something along the lines of severity in some manner of speaking. Okay, that would be one of the major reasons. And then there's one other one.
Chronicity.
Chronicity, again, just leans towards severity. It's a long, going on for many years. That's sort of the severity for them. Same part of the same thing.
Limitations of daily activities.
Limitation of activity, again, goes towards severity. All those things are what make it for that person considered a severe situation or headache.
Doesn't resolve
along the same lines.
Because they're scared that something is going on, like a tumor or something.
Exactly.
Like
that. It's that, or they're worried about a brain tumor. Yes, there's a few people that are really sophisticated and they're worried about the anterior communicating artery having a small, very aneurysm and it ruptures and gives them a cerebral bleed, but most people are not that sophisticated. They're just worried about a brain tumor. You know, this is going on for a while or it's very severe or that, and I'm worried about a brain tumor. And that's why when you see them after we finish going through all this stuff we're going to go through, by the end of your history, physical, blah, 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 whatever else you're going to do, tell them. It's not a brain tumor. Look them in the eye and tell them. And don't be uncertain. Don't say, I think it's not a brain tumor. This shouldn't likely be a brain tumor. It's only 1% chance. It's not a brain tumor. You really don't get brain tumors that are just headache. They present with something else. Something focal in some way, shape, or form. It would be the very rare brain tumor that presents just with headache. So you should really be able to come across in a confident way and tell them, I think it's this X type of headache. Here's what I'm going to do about it. You don't have a brain tumor. Okay. So getting a headache history is really all about being mute. Not moot. You're still important to the process. But you should really be mute. The person starts out with a headache and you start asking them, well, is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it right here? Is it throbbing? Yes, it's sharp, dull, right here, throbbing. Are you vomiting with a headache? Yes, I'm vomiting with a headache. You know, is your room spinning when you have it? Oh, room is spinning. I'm throwing up all over everyone. Anything you tell them, they'll usually incorporate in some way into the headache. So just be quiet. Just say, tell me more about your headache. Very open-ended style questioning. It's the rare person that is just, you know, sitting there and can barely tell you anything about their headache that you have to start using specific terms and pulling it out. For the most part, if you give people a chance and ask the right open-ended questions, they will tell you everything you actually need to know without you embellishing it by accident by telling them what to say. And as with many things in internal medicine, it's pattern recognition. And we're going to go over some of the key main common headaches, really the three most common headaches, that will help you recognizing the patterns that you're looking for mostly in clinic, but sometimes in the ER as well. Okay, so headache history is about being very open and quiet. Headache physical is not exactly your internist's usual physical. You know, you all kind of listen to the lungs, listen to your heart, you know, check out their belly, normal bowel sounds. Yeah, none of this has anything to do with their headache. Nor will any of that show you anything to do with the differential diagnosis of their headache. So you got to sort of step away. You can do those things if you want, just for documentation purposes. But when it comes down to it, do things that are going to help you with your headache differential diagnosis. And I put a smattering of those things, but you'll obviously have to sort of adjust this based on what you got from the history of the headache. Examine their head. You know, if they have a hat or a kippah on, you know, take it off. Look at their head. Move the hair around. See if there's any, you know, bore holes that maybe somebody drilled because they forgot to tell you about the subdural hematoma. Okay, that's going to be pretty rare. Look and feel the scalp. Look at their fundi. This is your one chance to, like, look right into their brain, basically. You're seeing vessels that are coming right out of their brain.
into their eye. You can look right in there, and while they're doing it, tell them, looking right at your brain, vessels look great. Looks normal. Move on to the next part of the exam. You've assuaged a lot of their fears with these simple little connections you can make during the physical exam of their brain, of their head. Listening to the orbits with a stethoscope. I haven't seen a lot of people do this, but if you're looking to catch that rare venous hum behind the eye of a vascular ectasia, you know, that might be one way you could pick it up. You actually have them close the eye, put the Bell's stethoscope over it, and then have them open it so that you don't get the fluttering of the lids together. And then you can listen sort of behind the eye like that. Try it out once, see if you like it. Checking the visual fields, always a good, quick, easy one. A, you might pick something up, and B, even if you don't, again, they're more sure that you have been thorough in examining parts of their brain that connect directly to their occipital lobe. Personally, I always try to do it with keeping one of their eyes closed, and then having your finger out, one of your fingers here, so you know they're looking at this finger, and you, from that side of the table, look at this finger, and then use your other hand so you can finally see when your visual field starts to hit your own finger, you know their visual field should already be hitting your finger as well. And that way you know whether they're missing parts of the visual field. I find that to be the most effective way to do that. Is there language normal? You can usually pick up on that right from the history. You don't even have to do that in physical. Can they tell their coherent story throughout the physical history? It's sort of a part of your physical of their brain, in a manner of speaking. Can they walk on a narrow base? Gets you some idea of their sensory and function like that. Checking reflexes, focus on the neurologic. Neurologic exam is probably more important than your usual internist exam. So that's something you should probably pay more attention to with these people as well. In the end, most of this is going to be normal. 99% of the time, it's all going to be normal. You're not wasting your time. A, you can bill for more because you've done a thorough physical exam and you document it. And B, they're going to be more comfortable with your diagnosis and actually believe in what you're saying because you've been this thorough. 50% of prescriptions in America do not get filled. That's how much times people don't believe what we're telling them. Doing these things is mostly not to find anything. It's going to be normal, almost always. You're doing it to convince this person you're being thorough. All right. So that was the history and the physical. Other diagnostic testing, really not commonly ordered. I think it's maybe once a year where I'll recommend somebody get like a CAT scan or an MRI of their brain for a headache. Not in the ER, maybe, for outpatients. ER, different population. You're worried about subarachnoid hemorrhages. You're worried about this stuff. Okay. I'll let it be a different algorithm. But in the clinic, very uncommon that I'll suggest somebody get one of these. If you're really worried about multiple sclerosis, you might need your MRI. CAT scan with contrast for a suspected tumor. You could probably do an MRI there also. So if you have, because of the history and physical, a very specific worry, then fine. You know, of course, go for it. But generally, 99% of the time, you just don't need any imaging or blood tests. The only time I really do a non-contrast CAT scan is if it's the only way they're going to stop worrying. So you have that person that's going to go doctor hopping, you know, all over the place, different clinics, see lots of specialists, see use it, and everybody's going to order lots of crap, spend up thousands and thousands of dollars. You can, on the occasional patient, you can just do away with all that spending and all that worrying by getting a $250 non-contrast CAT scan right away up front. If you figured out that this is the person to do that in, then it's cost effective to just get it over with. You can show them, look, your brain's normal, this is a tension type headache, or this is a, you know, whatever, and just get them to move on with their life. So once in a blue moon, we'll do it. But generally speaking, just don't order stuff for headache patients. It's just not worth it. I always thought this is a good a picture of what a headache might look like if you were drawing it. I also like to pretend I'm cultural. It's not really true. So, okay, so we have some cases. Last year, my negative feedback to myself was that we have to do things a little bit more case-based during my lectures. So I've tried adding a few cases in here and there. First case, case one, a 34-year-old woman, no medical history, complaining of headaches that are unilateral and throbbing, happen once or twice a week and last for 7 to 8 hours. When they occur, she feels a little nauseous and has to lie down for a while, away from the loud noises. They usually go away after she takes Excedrin over the counter from her local pharmacy, and red wine occasionally causes a headache. This kind of thing. Any of our interns have a suggestion as to what headache this might be?
Migraine.
Okay, a chorus of migraine came out. I wrote this case to be relatively obvious, so don't feel too good about yourself. And you know, it has a lot of the typical features that we're going to talk about with migraines. You don't have to have all of these typical features, but this one happens to have many typical features. Case 1B,
34-year-old woman with no medical history complains of headaches that are bilateral and dull, happen every 2 days, and last 3 to 5 hours. She also feels her pain in her neck. She keeps working during the headache, but is less productive. And Tylenol Excedrin works sometimes through the pain, but not always. How about this one? Yeah, that's why I wrote this question like this, because this person, I also wrote it as a migraine patient. Even though you could easily think to yourself, this could be a tension type headache patient. And it just shows you, I was trying on purpose to point out just how much overlap there is between many headache syndromes and how much you should sort of not pigeonhole yourself right away into one of them. Give it a chance to sort of play out and decide what it's going to be. Migraines have a lot of overlapping features, and for instance, the neck pain that I threw in there, some recent studies just came out showing that 80% of migraines have neck pain associated with them. And I know we always classically think of tension-type headaches when you think of neck pain. So we'll go over a lot more of this in the next few slides, but I on purpose wanted to give you this dichotomous 1A and 1B examples of your typical one where you just jump on it and you know you're right, and this one where you might have to sort of say, not sure, could this be migraine, could it be tension-type? Maybe we should try treating it as one or the other, and if it doesn't work, go try to treat the other one, and not just narrow yourself too quickly. All right. Migraine overview. Let's spend a few slides sort of going over a lot of the nitty-gritty of migraine, because I think this is one that you need to know a lot about. One of the most common headaches, 18% of women, 6% of men, so this is staggeringly common. Yes, it's 3 to 1, so you don't think about it on men, but even 6%, you know, every week you're going to see one guy with migraines if you have a private outpatient practice. So you really have to think about it for just about everyone when they tell you with headaches, not just women. The most common things are pulsating or pounding and unilateral, but it really doesn't have to be. I've heard so many descriptions that were not exactly pulsating or pounding, but still were migraines, and even ones that were bilateral. So you have to keep a pretty broad base on this. And I mentioned about the neck pain, not to be fooled about that. What causes migraines? I couldn't hear you.
Vasodilation.
Right, the classic answer. It's wrong, but it's the classic answer. We all learned that, and everything we learn in medical school is wrong by 10 years later.
Maybe the actual cause is unknown, but
sodium channel.
Oh, wow. He's going even further in the opposite direction into the basic science. I really rarely give a basic science. I never give a basic science lecture, so let's not go quite that far. It's neurologic, not vascular, is what it comes out to be. And it's a spreading depression, a depolarization of neurons, usually going from posterior to anterior, a wave of depolarization. Supposedly in the... what's the word? Thalamus. There is a migraine generator, it's referred to as, one of the areas, I don't know the subtleties of the number of the area, that kicks off this spreading wave of depolarization that occurs. But because of that, however that, you know, whatever ion channel causes that thalamic part to start this wave of depolarization, the point is, after it occurs, is where you wind up feeling the pain of this. What we normally don't feel. We all have pulsations in our brain going on from vessels, but you're only going to feel that as abnormal after that wave of depolarization. And that's why we always thought of it as vascular. But really, it's not. It's a neurologic phenomenon. Anyway, it may be that because of that wave of depolarization starting in the occiput, that is why a lot of people get those visual scotomata, and that may be the reason, because it starts in the occipital part. Is still not certain from what I understood. Okay. Three keys to the history. Any ideas? Any takers?
Localization.
I heard family history and I heard what?
Localization.
Localization.
The aura.
Aura. Pattern. None of these are the three things I was talking about. Wrong. There are parts of the story I asked for all of them, but there are three real keys that have been studied that are really make it stand out that this is probably a migraine.
Yeah.
Right, nobody mentioned the photophobia. I knew it was coming sooner or later, but...
right when you pop.
I believe. Nausea, vomiting. We mentioned it during the case, but nobody said it just now when I was saying it. And disability.
and it's actually disabling. You have to stop what you're doing. Not necessarily true of every migraineur, of course. You have some people with very, very mild migraines. They can keep doing what they're doing, but a classical way of it is. And these three are really ones that stand out the most of all those things you just mentioned. So I'm asking for all of them, and I'm listening for these three as the key bunch that I'm really trying to put my finger on. And the timeline is important too, that 4 hour to 3 day, while your tension types tend to be about how long, if you had a guess. Yeah, 1 to even 8 or 10, but most of the time it's 1, 2, 3, 4 hours, you know, something like that. So it even though there's overlap, and I told you there's going to be overlap with all of these headache scenarios, these do tend to have a much longer time course. And the reason that you have to be careful, I think, a little bit on this is that a lot of patients will self-medicate. So they've come to you having tried Tylenol and Excedrin and all these things, and some of them do break the headache. And you'll say to them, how long does your headache last? And they'll tell you 3 hours or 4 hours. But the key is, did they take something and it went away? And when they don't take something, how long does it really last? And you're going to get the whole day story, the whole night story, the whole 2 days, whatever it is. So yeah, tease that out a little bit with regard to the time course. What did I write at the bottom there? Any hemicranial headache, any pulsating headache, any neurological phenomenon lasting over 20 minutes may also help fill in, fine. 10% of migraine patients have an aura. So it's not a lot, but occasionally you get them. And 50% of the time, the aura does not have a headache afterwards. So you'll sometimes get somebody, it sounds like a TIA that they're coming in with. They tell you about some neurological phenomena, that's scotoma, or even a weakness. I've seen on an arm, let's say, I've seen a couple of those. And then it went away after a few hours or 20 minutes. And no headache happened afterwards, so you think maybe it's a TIA. You got to still think this could be the migraineur, and ask them to see if there are other patterns of headaches, especially with those phenomena as well, and maybe try to tie it in like that. My wife is probably a good example. I tend to use her for a lot of examples for things. Don't tell her I said that. She has migraines from, not childhood, but early adulthood. And she one time came home from work from a fellowship, when she was in fellowship, and was telling me about decreased visual field on one side. And I even looked in her eye and saw what I thought was this weird little, like, odd wedge-shaped looking thing that I didn't think I'd seen before in her eye, and I got a little freaked out. And my father happens to be a doctor. I brought her over to him for a second opinion. He didn't think he saw anything extraordinary, and her symptoms went away completely within one day, probably part of a migraine that she had, complicated migraine, as it's referred to, when you have that kind of neurological deficit. So false positive on what I saw in the eye, but the point was, you know, sometimes you're worried about, like, a real infarct or TIA, and it can be a migraine. Alright. So remember, the photophobia, nausea, vomiting, disability. Migraine cycle, so there are things, some of you mentioned some of these things that sort of co-travel with the migraineur, and they can help you tease out parts of the story when it's not clear. They get more infantile colic, so you can really go back to their history. Matter if you ask the parents on that one. Childhood abdominal pain. This one is actually, I think, very useful, at least it was to me. My daughter, when she was 4, 5, 6, had a lot of childhood abdominal pain. She started getting headaches and probably has the migraines that my wife likely handed down to her. Tends to be a very common thing to run in families with the women, mother to daughter. She probably had childhood abdominal pain as being what you might, I guess, refer to as like an intestinal migraine, because there's a lot of neurological connection, as you know, to the gut. And that was probably that. Frequently menstrual incontinence, common one, motion sickness, they get more red wine headache. The unfortunate benign sex headache, that's got to suck. At orgasm, you get a headache. Damn. Ice cream headache. This is not necessarily like the ice cream headache like you and I get. You just eat something cold. It kind of stimulates you to have a couple minutes of, oh, you know, got brain freeze, and it goes away in 2 minutes. These, it actually triggers a migraine. But from some studies, there's a lot of connection to some of the nerves in the mucosa here, up behind the back of the teeth. There's actually some studies going on of like these almost little patches of NSAIDs, you might say, that you can sort of stick on the gum line here for migraineurs. So probably the ice cream is just stimulating there and then setting off a migraine. Worsening headache with life stressors, that's probably true of many headache types, though, unfortunately. They do get more cerebrovascular disease, strokes, things like that, so good luck again to my wife. Transient global amnesia, a little bit increased, but not that common anyway. And then they have a lot of other things like co-travel, unfortunately. Depression, bipolar, generalized anxiety disorder, social phobias. They're all more likely to be migraineurs. Just sometimes you can use these little things to help fill in your story and make you more sure if this is the kind of headache you're dealing with. the mild to moderate ones, you know, you see a lot of these people and you don't even see a lot of them because they don't even come in complaining, a lot of them. They'll just treat themselves with massages, relaxation techniques, avoiding light, going to bed, NSAIDs, all this kind of stuff. You know, they just try it themselves. They don't even go to the doctor. So a lot of the mild migraine you're not even seeing. And Cedric Migraine, I mentioned on here, not because I own stock in the company, wish I did, could have made a lot of money 20 years ago, but because it's just so common for people to take it, because it has three great ingredients, aspirin, acetaminophen, and caffeine, all of which can help you with headaches. Does that sound like any other prescription drug, you know? Aspirin, acetaminophen, caffeine? The prescription version of it has acetaminophen, butalbital, and caffeine instead?
Furoset,
yeah. Or Furanol. Depends. Furoset is the one with acetaminophen, butalbital, and caffeine, and Furanol has aspirin, butalbital, and caffeine. And those are at Montefiore's Headache Clinic from way back. It was Montefiore's Headache Clinic. That was where they got the names. And those kind of drugs, like Furoset and Furanol, work really nicely. Of course, they can cause other trouble. We'll talk about it on a different slide later. But the company wanted to do it over-the-counter, the Excedrin company, and the butalbital was the one thing you needed a prescription for. So they dumped the butalbital, took the aspirin, and they said, if we put it together, and the caffeine, and made this great little drug that does work for a lot of people. It can have some of the negative side effects of Furoset and Furanol that I'm going to talk about other slides also. So I wouldn't necessarily say everybody should use it every day for the rest of their life, but it can be a nice thing. A lot of people will use it on their own. The acute treatments for the moderate or severe migraineurs are expensive, the triptans. The triptans is kind of what you know is kind of the mainstay of it. Ergotamines aren't really used anymore. I mean, I've never used one. I've never even seen somebody use one. Now that the triptans came out 15 years ago or whatever it was, it's taken over the whole market. But they're very expensive. They're quite safe, but they're very expensive. You got to use it really early. We're talking the headache starts, take it immediately. Don't wait, well, maybe it's a mild one, I can get away with not taking it this time. You know, by the time you've decided that, you know, the cat is out of the bag. You got to just, you know, it's your migraine's coming on, and most people know when their migraine's coming on. Not during the aura. They actually don't work during the aura. But when the headache itself starts, just take it. The studies are extremely clear. The more hours you wait after the headache starts, the efficacy just plummets. Oh yeah, I put the numbers there, I forgot. So when you take it really early, you get 50% relief at 2 hours, 85% of people by 4 hours. They'll help you within a few hours, usually, most people. But you got to take it early. Otherwise, it drops to half that within a few hours, half that efficacy. And if the headache goes on for more than 1 to 2 hours, they say you can take a second dose. You can take it during the prodrome, but not the aura. The aura specifically, that happens beforehand for 10 minutes. You can't take it during that. And avoid it in pregnancy. Unfortunately, it's category C. There is a side effect of chest pain. It's not actually myocardial. It's less than 1 in 1 million to have a heart attack from this thing. And it's almost always in people at risk, you know, people that have a lot of risk factors for it. But that the regular person, the young woman that gets it with chest pain, it's not a myocardial chest pain. Actually, from what I understood from some reading, has to do with the small vessels of the wall of the chest getting a little bit of constriction and giving you some superficial pain. They can be used with an SSRI. That whole worry about serotonin syndrome, extraordinarily rare. I wouldn't use it with two other serotonin drugs. But with just if the person's on it for depression, that's okay. You can still use the occasional triptan. Because remember, you're not using triptans daily. It's a once in a while thing when you have a headache. Not contraindicated if you have oral contraceptives. But if you start adding on risk factors for strokes, you know, you get the oral contraceptive, and they're a person who has auras, the people with auras are even higher risk for strokes, and they're a smoker, you know, start to add on more and more, then you got to stop it. So you got to say, this is too risky. So you have any one of these, no problem. You start to have two or three of them, I would probably be careful. They are all available PO, but I wanted to point out specifically some of the ones that are, a lot of them are nauseated, as you know, the migraineurs, and so they'll either vomit it up, or even if they don't vomit it up, when you're nauseated during a migraine, you don't actually absorb as well. There are studies showing that your stomach does not absorb as well during that episode. So you might want to think about the other ones. Sumatriptan is the only one available as injectable, but that's extremely expensive. Like $100 a shot or something like that. It's a lot of money. And a lot of women don't like using needles. Like, imagine, remember in clinic, all those patients that are diabetics that don't want to shoot insulin. You know, same idea. They're not going to want to do it a lot of patients. But it is probably the one that has the quickest efficacy. So if you have somebody whose migraine sort of starts at time A, and time B, 20 minutes later, is already like terrible, you know, people have a very rapid rise, you may not want to use a PO one that takes more than 20 minutes to absorb. You might want to use the injectable one so you can get very quick efficacy for that kind of person. So that might be one person I would pick it as a first line. Intranasal ones, sumatriptan, Zolmi, and Riza all have intranasal. I've never tried it, but I've been told it has a bad aftertaste, like as it runs the back of the nose, and a lot of people don't like it for that reason. But quick absorption, not as quick as the injectable, but quicker than the PO. So some people might want to try it. And sublingual, which I thought is probably the best thing in a lot of ways, and I've had my wife try that specifically. The Zolmi and Riza, I use the Rizatriptan for her, are available as a little wafer. You just put it under the tongue, it dissolves in 30 seconds, whatever, and it's gone. It's nice, comes in a little, I don't know the stock in these companies, comes in like a little box that you have your things in, women can put it right, the little box right in the purse, go to the bathroom, pop it open, slip it under the tongue, go right back into their meeting if they're at work, whatever, you know, it's kind of a nice, quick, easy thing to do. And what else did I point out? Of the PO, of the oral ones, Frova and Nara are the slowest to act, and so you figure, why would I ever use them? But if you have the kind of person where they get a triptan, it works, but 3 hours later they get a rebound headache, their migraine comes back. Some people that happens. Then these two might be the right thing for that person, because then it'll still be in effect for many, many hours later. Because it's slower to absorb, but it's much, much slower to get rid of it. So it's a much longer peak, much longer arc. So that might be the time to use those, Frova and Nara. The other ones that I haven't named above there are Elotriptan and Amitriptan. Ella was the most recent one that came out a bunch of years ago, so the company tried to say it's better than all the others, like all pharmaceutical companies tend to do. It's not. They're all basically equally effective, so it's all a load of crap. I would, if I were you, just pick one or two of them. Probably maybe one that's available sublingual, and maybe one that's available PO, or something like that. Just get comfortable with using them so you know how to quickly write prescriptions for them. You don't have to memorize all 7 or 8 of them. Just pick a couple. All right. I think it's the last slide on migraines. If the patient does not respond, they still have a good chance, like 80% was quoted in one study, of responding to other triptans. So try out several different ones. It took me 3 different triptans to get to the one, the Riza, that my wife used to use. They can use 10 milligrams of metoclopramide so that you can sort of get rid of some of that nausea, vomiting. I'm not sure it honestly makes a big difference. I was just reading a review of one article from a few weeks ago where they, I think it was one of these... what are they called, Cochrane reviews, and using metoclopramide with or without the metoclopramide in the ER was no different for efficacy. So granted, I'm not talking in the ER, my talk is for outpatient medicine, but I'm not sure it really changes much. If the person says it helps them, or if you want to try it, it's fine. Can use triptans more than twice a week on average. So if the person's having 3 headaches a week, this is a person that, you know, doesn't just need to get acute therapy. It's probably somebody you need to think of prophylaxis, which will be on the next slide we'll talk about more. So you really have to use this only once or twice a week. And they are contraindicated in patients that have known vascular disease. Even though, like I said, it's still extraordinarily rare, the warning on the label is not to use it for those people. We already said nobody uses ergotamines. Steroids, right. I threw steroids in because it's a nice thing to have in your back pocket. I've used this just 2 or 3 or 4 times in my life, but it can really help. You have that person that's sort of status migrainist, they're kind of stuck in a migraine, 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, like can't stand it anymore. I had one patient in the ER, Westchester, that was in like 2 or 3 days of status migrainist so bad she wanted to kill herself. They admitted her to the psych ER. It was that bad. They called me as a consultant, and I gave her 20 milligrams of prednisone for 2 days, 20 one day, 20 the next day. Came back to see her as follow-up, headache gone, felt well, they were discharging her the next day. So it's a nice sort of back pocket trick when you don't know what the hell else to do. There are some people that will tell you use much more than 20, use 100 milligrams. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine exactly about that. I think it was a few years back, I might want to take a peek. I've never really seen any studies showing why 20 would be better than 40, or better than 80, or better than 100, or any, so why use a huge dose when you can probably get the same efficacy with a low dose is my thinking on it. But I guess if 20 didn't work, maybe I would try a higher dose. And I already mentioned about Furoset and Furanol. Just you have to use it on a limited basis so they can get rebound headaches. Kind of like that shot of what it might feel like to get a migraine headache, nailing a nail into the side of your head. So prophylaxis, the last slide on migraines is about prophylaxis. Who do we have to give prophylaxis to? I guess I just alluded to this. So if they're having them frequently, and I said that twice, more than twice a week, but we have to use some judgment on it. If you have a woman who's a CEO of a company, and she's getting migraines twice or three times a month, but they're hard to treat, they last 24 hours, her meetings are all ruined for the day, you know, that's not twice a week or more than twice a week, but it's really bad for her work or for her quality of life or for her function. You might want to consider giving it to that person. I think it should be a judgment call at my point, and not to use too hard a firm line in the sand. I guess that's what I summarized there in my comment. But if you want to just remember a kind of a rule of thumb, if you have twice a week or more, that's where you would start thinking about. Chronic prophylaxis for these moderate or severe, mild migraines, you're probably not going to give them prophylaxis no matter how often they have it, but they have moderate or severe pain with it. What can we use? What medication groups can we use for this? Beta blockers, I heard from a couple people. What else?
TCAs,
I heard. And what was that? Calcium blockers is not one of the main three groups, but it was always quoted as it when I was learning this, and it's just wrong. So I don't put it as one of the three main groups now. TCAs, I heard. Beta blockers, and there's one more. Anti-seizure medications. Tokamax is one of them, but I'm just broadening it to be anti-seizure medication. So it's kind of the three main groups you should think about when I think, okay, I've got to give this person something. What do I pick from? So how do I pick between them? I put it on the bottom, calcium channel blockers, weak evidence, like we said. And even candesartan and lisinopril, interestingly, have some interesting evidence. So if you couldn't use the three main groups, I might consider trying this, as long as their blood pressure isn't going to bottom out. But mainly I'm thinking about these three groups. Tricyclics, there are four main ones: amitriptyline, nortriptyline, disipramine, and imipramine. And I put them in that order on purpose, because the order I put them in there is in the order of highest amount of side effects, anticholinergic side effects, to least. So even though amitriptyline is basically the only one that is FDA approved for migraines, I don't use it rarely. For migraine orders. I tend to use nortriptyline. It seems to have the same efficacy from what anyone is ever able to tell in any study or any person who's ever taught me, and has less of it. So I pretty much almost only use nortriptyline. And I started really, really dinky doses. We're talking like 10 milligrams, or homeopathic doses. And I started people on that, and they come back and tell me like 6 months later, I haven't had one headache since. Maybe not every person has efficacy quite that good, but you can really do a lot of good with very small doses of tricyclics. If it doesn't work, of course, I'll titrate up. But you usually don't need those depression doses, like when we used to use it for depression more tricyclics, for SSRIs. You don't need the 100 milligram doses usually. You can get away with 10, 25, maybe 50 at most. Usually 10 or 25 is just well. Does great. The first three of those you would do before bed because they're a little sedating, and the final one, disipramine, is more if you're going to do it in the morning, more activating. So since, again, a lot of people have trouble sleep, I figure let's just kill two birds with one stone. I use the nortriptyline before bed, helps them avoid headaches, helps them get to sleep. Kind of a win-win. I do ask for an EKG before starting because of the whole worry about QT prolongation, but it's probably pretty overblown, but I guess to be safe, I would rather have the EKG. They're pretty much a good first line or at the most second line choice for both men and women. I tend to pick it as a good first line for both. Beta blockers, on the other hand, mainly for propranolol and nadolol, specifically those two because they're non-selective. You want the ones that are non-selective because the non-selective ones cross the blood-brain barrier. And the other ones don't cross them as well. So these are going to work better for migraineurs because you've got to get into the brain. That's what you're trying to prophylax. So I tend to pick one of those two. There's some studies with metoprolol. It seems to do okay, surprisingly, but I tend to pick these two most of the time. Everybody worries about impotence, fatigue, depression. The depression thing, total non-starter. There's some recent studies showing beta blockers don't even cause depression like we used to worry about forever. So that's kind of a medical myth. And the whole thing about impotence also, very, very rare. There's, again, some studies showing it's no different than placebo for causing impotence in men. So I really don't worry about it that much. Of course, I'm not the one taking it. It's not something that would stop me. If a person complained that they felt like they were getting impotent because of it, okay, I'll stop it. But I don't let it dissuade me from trying it in men. That might be a good reason why it's a second line for men instead of first line. But I would try it. I would have no problem trying it on a man if I couldn't use tricyclics. So again, good first or second line, more for women because of the impotence thing, but you can use it. And lastly, the anti-seizure medication is the main two, valproic acid and topiramate. But there are others that have been studied, gabapentin, pregabalin, and even carbamazepine and other ones. Just these have the most studies, so I put up the ones that you should probably remember first. I would just be a little bit careful about using them in women because of the pregnancy issues and stuff like that. So I tend to think women, tricyclics and beta blockers, men, tricyclics and anti-seizure medication. Kind of my first line, second line, just to avoid side effects and possible problems. Okay. Headache case 1A. So if we go back to this woman, should she... This is the one that had the more classic syndrome. Should this person get prophylaxis?
No.
Once or twice a week, 7 to 8 hours, has to lie down.
Yes.
You're a tough ass. Suck it up!
If she has time to sleep.
If she has time to sleep. Because women don't work. It's somebody I would consider it in, especially if the triptans don't help her. I would consider it. I wouldn't say no to this person if they said that they thought they needed the prophylaxis. It's not a definite, but I would consider it. And this other person? Every 2 days, last 3 to 5 hours? Can keep working, but less productive. I would consider it. Maybe the person says they don't want to take something every day, if they can just take every other day, some NSAIDs, and it works fine. Maybe, you know, something like that. But I would consider it. These are things we should all weigh the balances and talk to the patient, make a mutual decision. That'll give you a headache.
Yeah.
All right. Migraine took up most of the talk, and I knew that. The other two headaches are much more focused, so don't worry. I know you're thinking, oh my God, it's 1:10 or whatever. You know, this is going to be a 3-hour lecture. We'll be done in like 10 minutes. Hang in there. So a 37-year-old program director of a true lesson residency gets a daily headache. These headaches frequently occur in the afternoon after hearing multiple complaints from house staff all day. They're bilateral temporal, and he can continue to work right through them. They are sometimes relieved with Tylenol. Sound like anyone you know? What kind of headache might this poor bastard have?
How old are you?
Actually, I just turned 38. I got to change the slide. I just realized this is all being recorded. I got to stop saying that. What kind of headache do you think this poor guy has? This is pretty classic for tension. Come on a little more as the day progresses because they've had time to accrue annoyances or things that stress them. A common thing can be bilateral temporal. Other places you might hear about tension type? We said the neck before, good.
So frontal, so people.
Yeah, sometimes a band either just in the front or a band connecting to the temporal and even to the back. Why this area? Why that area do they mostly do it? Forget the neck for a moment, but why that area? Right? There are muscles there. Which two main ones?
Frontalis.
Occipital frontalis goes over the top as an apodorosis. And temporalis. So if there's something that goes around like this, it doesn't really go exactly around like this. It's two different sets of muscles, but they're feeling it like that because that's where the muscles, you know, this main set here, and then here, and then the ones on the sides. They kind of tell you like that. So is this actually what would be the cause of this? Is this actually muscle pain? Is it a muscle headache? What's causing this?
Spasm? Muscle spasm?
It's sodium channel.
Right, I knew somebody. I thought he was going to do it. But it's not actually caused by muscle spasm, which is what we always kind of thought. That's why it was named originally tension headache. It was like a tension in the muscle. But if you noticed before, about 40 minutes ago, when I said tension type. It was changed to tension type when they made the international classification for headaches. Neurologists need to have something to do in their spare time, so they made international classification for headaches. And it was called tension type on purpose, because it's not caused by tension. You feel it as tension. It's not caused by it. It's a psychogenic headache. It's something in your thinking, in your brain, but we don't understand it. It's something psychogenic. I don't tell the patient, by the way, you have a psychogenic headache. They'll even go to another doctor. I'll tell them they have tension type headache. That they understand. They know what tension feels like. They can understand that. But it's a psychogenic headache is what it comes down to at this point. I'm sure 20 years from now, 50 years from now, when someone else is giving this lecture,
or me if you haven't killed me by then, you know, they'll have a better explanation. But to the best that we know, it's psychogenic. So stress. Stress is the perfect word here. Everybody can understand stress. Very hard to define exactly what stress is, but people know when they have stress. So about half the time, when house staff are presenting cases to me in the clinic about headaches, dizziness, lots of different main common complaints, I'll go back in the room with them and I'll say to the patient, so what stresses do you have going on in your life right now? Like half the time they break down crying in front of me and tell me stuff the house staff didn't get from them. So try this. Use this question. Tell me about stress going on in your life, or what stresses are going on, or what's changed that's stressful in your life. Some version of that. Incredibly useful question. And then finding ways to help them with the stress is really the key to solving their tension type headache. You can do anything you want. You can give them any drug in the book, Tylenol, acetaminophen, butalbital, whatever. You can give them narcotics. It'll help temporarily. It will still keep coming back until you help them with their stress. And you figure, well, how am I going to help them with their stress? You know, it's their life. But it could be as simple as taking a minute and finding out and suggesting some things to them, like maybe they need to start doing yoga or Tai Chi, or maybe they need to change their job because it's killing them. I mean, just simple things, but it's coming from you as an official person counseling them can really help them decide to make changes in their life that will help them. So even just a minute of some counseling. All right, final case. So we said migraines, tension-type headaches. We got two of the three main headaches you need to know about. Third one, 37-year-old program director of internalizing residency gets almost daily headache. These headaches frequently occur in the morning. They're bilateral, temporal, and he can continue working right through them. They're sometimes relieved when drinking his large mug of tea. Damn, I shouldn't have brought it with me. Sounds very close to the last case. What do you think this guy has? Paint. Is that wishful thinking? Or? What?
The morning he has excess sleep.
Excess sleep? You think I get too much sleep? I have three kids at home. Give me a break. I know I'm not overnight because I'm on call like you guys, but my tension type, and what's the third? Doesn't sound like cluster, does it? I used to leave cluster in this talk as the third common headache, and I gotta tell you, it's so freaking uncommon I took it out of the talk. I've still never convinced myself I've seen one cluster headache after practicing for 10 years, so I dropped it down to number four. It's off the talk.
Caffeine.
I heard caffeine. I heard overuse somewhere. Hangover. We're all getting to the right genre of this third headache. It's called, in the literature, it's called chronic headache, is what it's referred to as. And these people that have chronic daily headache have sort of what you were alluding to, this overuse kind of syndrome. Maybe they're using caffeine too often, too many big cups of coffee or tea every morning, and then if they don't have it one morning, whatever, start to get a headache, they have to use more of it. Sometimes they even continue it and keep getting headaches, even though they're continuing it now because they've built up so much need for it. The more common scenario probably, and this is why I mentioned Furoset and Furanol, is people, this is very common 10, 20 years ago, they use that for their migraine, let's say, once a week. And then the migraine kind of comes back every 4 days instead of once a week, and they use it then again. So now they're using it, the butalbital, the Furanol, Furoset, twice a week, or maybe three times a week, or maybe 2 days in a row. And then they start to use it several days that are chronic daily headaches because of the Furoset. And now they start to use the Furoset daily, and then it doesn't even eventually help the headache anymore. Now they're getting headache daily and using the Furoset daily. They don't realize the Furoset, or even sometimes Excedrin migraine, if you use it too often, is now causing your headache. It's not helping your headaches. It's one of the reasons these are the hardest group to treat out of all three we just talked about. Because you have to convince these people to stop all of their medication, whatever it is that they're overusing, caffeine, drugs, whatever, you know, whatever it is that's giving them their headache, that's eventually become chronic daily headache. Frequently, it will be that they originally had migraine, or they originally had tension type, and it worked its way into a chronic daily headache over weeks or months or years because of the things that they used for the first headache. So you really have to dig a little bit, sort of figure out, go back in time. When did you first start getting headaches? Tell me, what did they feel like back then? Not now, but I want to go back then. How often were they 3 years ago when you started? If you really go back, you can sometimes pin it down
okay, you used to have migraines, you now have chronic daily headache, we have to get you off of everything you're on. It can be very hard to convince these people, but if you do it, you can really cure like 80% of them. If you really have to, you can use steroids also in these people. If they really just, you stop everything, it doesn't work, or you can't get them to stop without giving them something, you can give them steroids also, and it kind of sort of like resets the brain almost, you know, just calms the whole thing down and hopefully breaks them out of it. And then they can go back into their first pattern of when they used to have tension headaches or migraines or whatever it was back then.
So the cause, it's the medication they're taking, the pills are the cause, and they may have started with other things that became chronic daily headache. I think we pretty much said all of that. I mentioned about the last-ditch effort, steroids. And these are my daughters in a box.
If I get a headache, I just close it up.
So, your differential, 99% of headaches, migraine, tension type, chronic daily headache.
If you know these three well from everything I just said, you'll be able to handle 99% of what comes to you in clinic. And that last 1%, maybe you need that non-contrast head CT, or maybe you need a neurologist, or if you're really worried, they go to the ER for a stat workup if you think it's a worst headache of their life for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Or that 1% could be that cluster guy that you maybe see once or twice in your career if you're an internist. But 99% of the time, you're going to go right if you think of these three and work with it. Any questions, comments, thoughts, anecdotes, short stories, jokes?
Hypertension
is staggeringly uncommon to really be causing your headache. These patients that come into clinic and say, I know my blood pressure's up because I have a headache, it is almost always just not true. We've had plenty of people inpatient-wise that have 200, 250 with no headache. These people that walk around with 160, 170, 180, 190, and they come in saying, I have a headache from my blood pressure, they don't. They have headaches. They have high blood pressure. Let's treat both and move on with it. It's not that common to feel your blood pressure. Very, very uncommon.
Oxygen for migraines?
Oxygen just for the clusters. But we didn't, like I said, I tried to focus on the 99%. The clusters are so infrequent. There, now you know everything you need to know about clusters. You have a cluster with cluster headache, give them oxygen. Done. We finished number four on this. All right, any other thoughts? Okay, see, we still made it on time, 1:22. Have a good day.